saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Thank you to Mint Mobile for sponsoring this episode.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening.
Ali Davis is a healthcare professional, nonprofit founder, and the survivor of alleged domestic childhood torture. She was born in Alaska, and as early as she can remember, the alleged torture that she would face at the hands of her mother had begun. It would take her years to come to realize the weight of all that she navigated, and to be able to name it appropriately. Amidst her healing journey, she launched a nonprofit foundation called Pretty Graffiti, which was established to provide funding for humanitarian aid for survivors of non-war-related childhood torture in the United States. Ali is paving the way for survivors and researchers alike, bringing awareness and prevention as a result of her efforts. The Broken Cycle Media team is so deeply grateful that she was willing to share her time, energy, expertise, and deeply empathetic views with our audience.
My name is Ali Davis. If you go on my social media, you will see across all platforms, my little tagline is queer, Arab, tired. And that pretty much encapsulates my current existence. I'm in grad school working on my Master of Public Health. I also run a nonprofit, first of its kind in the country. What we focus on is humanitarian aid for survivors of domestic childhood torture. Got into that work because I am a survivor myself. When I'm not working to address the full scope of the horrors of the world, I'm usually at home in my hammock or holding my cats or going on a random hike with my spouse. My maternal great-great-grandfather came to the U.S. from Syria. I believe it was early 1920s. The story that I was told was the reason why he left there and came here was because he wanted to marry a white woman who was the daughter of Christian missionaries. That's how they met. There was a missionary family over there, and him and the daughter met and fell in love. The family did not approve of him marrying a white Christian woman. And so he left home, ran away with her essentially, and came here and started a life. First generation trying very hard to assimilate. The Arab part of my family became Christian, but somewhere along the way, it became very extreme. And by the time my mother was raising me, it had evolved. Additionally, with the history of the Arab side of my family, the rhetoric that I grew up with was that I deserved everything that was happening to me. Everything that was happening to me was required because, according to the Bible, the sins of the fathers passed down 7 generations, and we were only 4 generations away from being Muslims. What I know of my mother's childhood was not good. And so you have a very traumatized woman giving birth in the early 90s, and her brain has basically been hijacked by extreme religious ideology. looking back and understanding more about perinatal mental health, she was in an extremely vulnerable place. She never had the time or opportunity to come out of and process her own trauma before becoming a mother herself. And then you have the larger social landscape playing a role. I was born and raised in Alaska. I lived there until about 9 months after my 18th birthday. Early 90s to 2000s, Alaska is very conservative. I was born in my parents' apartment with a midwife. My earliest memory that I can remember is taking the number 2 candle out of my 2-year birthday cake when I thought nobody was watching and like licking the frosting off of it. And my grandmother seeing me from across the room, and she just like pursed her lips and shook her head. But the other piece that was behind that was relief that it was my grandma that saw me and not my mom. Around that same time, I remember I had a babysitter who came fairly regularly because my parents were very deeply involved in an MLM at the time. One day before they left, I remember my mom, she sits down on the couch and calls me over and she's like, "You need to behave for her. And I'm going to show you what's going to happen if I find out that you don't behave." And she pulled me over her lap and spanked me, then left. According to my mother's own bragging admission, she started hitting me when I wouldn't go to sleep when I was 6 months old. It was a lot of pieces like that that were forming the landscape that my brain was growing up in. But then there were extravagant things like when I turned 2 or 3, inviting everyone over to surprise me with my own sandbox in the backyard. What nobody saw was all the nice things then being used as leverage to control my behavior. In like a cruel, if you don't do what I say today, I'm going to invite all your friends over to play in your sandbox while you sit on the porch and watch them and can't join. So obviously at that point, I already knew that there was so much danger in the home that I lived in. My father, he was a typical 90s macho male parent, so he wasn't faultless, but he played no role in the torture. They moved into a home when I was a little bit under a year old, and we lived in that home until the CPS case. CPS, it's Child Protective Services now, but in Alaska in the 90s, it was actually DFYS, which was the Division of Family and Youth Services. So the CPS report, it was in September of that year, which means I would have been 3. I do have the original case file. It was given to me when I turned 18. She requested the file 2 days after the actual home visit occurred and presumably received it. She held on to it all those years. What was alleged, according to the case assessment that I have right here, presenting problems, quote, minor locked in the closet and fed peas under the door. Minor's behavior is disturbed. Let's walk through the timeline of the CPS report. So the date the report was received was September 8th of 1995. It was assigned to a caseworker 3 days later on September 11th, 1995. On September 13th, 1995, they came to the door, and what they documented is mother answered the door, had been asleep, left card. She will call to schedule a time to meet and talk. So the caseworker was not allowed into the home. She said, "You know what? Now's not a good time. Why don't we schedule a time?" Which is wild. She told me that my dad's parents were trying to take me away from them. That's who she said she thought made the report. After that first knock on the door, my mom took me and her somewhere, and I don't remember exactly where, but we had a family friend who had a plane, which is not as luxurious as it sounds. In Alaska, a lot of people have small prop planes because a lot of places are only accessible by air or boat. It wasn't a private jet or anything. He flew us somewhere, and then we ended up at a different family friend's house. Nobody except the person we were staying with and the guy who flew the plane knew where we were. I was fucking terrified. I was like, what is happening? We're hiding like fugitives. And then we go back to the house. I had been coached and prepped on how to behave and what to say and what not to say. On September 18th, 5 days after the attempted home visit, 10 days after the report was received, my parents and the caseworker finally got in touch, and a home visit was scheduled for the next day at 1 p.m. The next day, September 19th, the social worker made an error in the time. She thought it was scheduled for 2 p.m. So the home visit did not occur on the 19th. 6 days later, they spoke on the phone and rescheduled the home visit for September 26th at 4 p.m. For those keeping track, that's 18 days after the report was received and 13 days, almost 2 weeks, after the initial attempt at a home visit where my mother answered the door and said, come back later. The only encounter with a caseworker that I remember was the day that they did the home visit. I remember walking around with her. I remember somebody carrying a big old tape recorder, running with the little cassette tape in there. I remember the house being pretty full, like a lot of people being there. In the caseworker's notes, she says they had the home visit and conducted an interview with both of my parents. Also present were two friends of theirs at their request. The parents taped the conversation. Parents are concerned about the report and insisted on showing me the closet doors in the home. None of the closet doors had locks of any kind, and I did not observe any evidence of previous locks. The parents explain that their daughter does have numerous food allergies and does eat a lot of peas. Parents deny their daughter has ever been locked in a closet. And when I finally read through it, when I was starting to piece my life together, I remember reading in here where the caseworker talks about the visit and what she saw and didn't see in the home. And she mentions, I didn't see any evidence of any locks on any of the closet doors. My immediate visceral reaction is I was like, you don't need a lock for a sliding closet door. You just put a dowel down in the track. The case was closed with no further intervention recommended.
Thank you again to Mint Mobile for sponsoring this episode. After years of overpaying for wireless, I finally got fed up with crazy high wireless bills, bogus fees, and free perks that actually cost more in the long run. So when my eldest kiddo was old enough for a phone line, I knew I had to sign her up for Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Bring your own phone and number, activate with eSIM in minutes, and start saving immediately. No long-term contracts, no hassle. And when I talk about high-speed data on a large network, I mean it. My daughter's reception was better than mine, so naturally, I had to sign up for Mint Mobile, too. I'm telling you, it's worth the hype. If you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/WCN. That's mintmobile.com/WCN. Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month 5-gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
The CPS report, I knew what it meant from the day that it happened. I knew that it meant in kid language that someone wanted to take me away from my parents, from my home, and put me somewhere else with a different family in foster care. She would tell me that they're going to take you somewhere where they're going to hurt you. You think you have it tough here. It's going to be worse. A lot of people going through a CPS investigation aren't going to talk about it to a lot of people. That's not really something that you bring up to all your best friends. But she went the opposite direction with it. She made sure everybody and their brother and their brother's mama knew that this was happening to us. She was a volunteer with Make-A-Wish at the time. She was pissed because she said that the investigation made it so that she couldn't volunteer anymore. And so it became an assault on her. It became a, look what I've gone through. Look how persecuted I am. It was kind of almost a trophy. Shortly after the investigation, from that cozy little two-bedroom suburban house with neighbors on each side and a nice little yard and a big wraparound porch, we moved from that to a one-room dry cabin For people not familiar with that terminology, a dry cabin in Alaska is a cabin that has no plumbing, no running water, no electricity, no heating. It was pretty much just a large room with two very small countertops. I don't even remember where we kept perishable food because there was not a refrigerator. A little loft that fit a twin mattress and a few stuffed animals. And that's where I slept. To get to it, you climbed up like a wooden ladder. And then there was a room that was a quote unquote bathroom, but all my baths were in like one of those steel wash tubs. Honestly, don't even remember where we used the bathroom. It might have been in an outhouse outside. And then we had a wood stove for heat because we were there during a winter. We had no phone. We had no connection with the outside world. We did our laundry at the laundromat in town, which was probably a 15 or 20 minute drive away. And we lived there maybe just under 2 years. And then at that time, we moved into a duplex. It was us on one side and another family on the other side. And when we moved into the duplex is when things really escalated. That's when water torture actually started. Another thing that was used a lot was solitary confinement, everything being taken out of my room except for my Bible and my bare mattress bed, only allowed out for a few bathroom breaks a day. And she would sometimes tell me, if bread and water is good enough for people in prison, then it's good enough for you. So that's all I'm legally required to give you. And that would be my meals. Even that I had better than a lot of torture survivors because some torture survivors weren't allowed out of their room to use the bathroom. I would be in my room screaming. And to get me to shut up, she would come and get a big bucket of cold water and like a cup. She would like stand in my doorway and she would have the cup full of cold water and she would throw the water on me. And she would do that until I was drenched. Then I would take off my clothes, and forced nudity is also a torture tactic that kind of plays a role in this. But eventually she realized that making me stay in the wet clothes would prolong my suffering. So then I stopped being allowed to take them off. One of my core memories of that time was she was beating me and I was screaming. My theory in my head, I was like, if you're going to make me suffer, I'm going to make sure your eardrums take a little damage. And so I would scream until my voice gave out. So one day she's wailing on me and I'm screaming and she stops. She opens my bedroom window and she goes, go ahead, scream louder. Maybe they'll come get you. My brain short circuited. I was like, oh, what if it's worse? I knew from an early age, the realm of possibility in the world is infinite. There's always something worse out there. And then we lived in another duplex situation where it was us and then the landlord who lived in the other unit. So we had to pretty much emergency evac out of that living situation, which ended up being a terrible time for me because then we moved in with someone from our church who had actually been sexually abusing me since I was almost 5 years old. Perpetrators of sexual abuse, they look for victims that are convenient for them. They look for victims who are already traumatized. They look for victims who are isolated. And the severity of the maltreatment escalated immensely. She would hit me for hours. That was something that was difficult to unpack because the language surrounding what I grew up in, it mirrored when I finally did have peers. Everyone in the 90s got spanked. I didn't have any reason to understand that my experience truly was any different than any of my peers. Everyone was talking about like, I got spanked, I got a lecture, whatever. I didn't understand that those words didn't mean the same thing in their households that they meant in mine. Not that hitting is okay in any form, but for most of my peers, getting spanked was like 3 to 5 swats on the butt. Not okay, but very different from being stripped naked, hit with an object for hours until you stop crying. I was also responsible for maintaining the household starting at 7. The cleaning. She did a lot of the cooking. I did a lot of the cooking, but all the cleaning. My parents were having a house built. And shortly after that, we lived with my grandparents until the house was finished. And then we moved into the house. And then that's the home that I lived in until I graduated high school. I had felt closer to my father for quite some time as a younger child. And then as my father got busier with work and school, because he was doing both for a while and traveling all over the state, he just wasn't around a lot. And I was literally trapped with my mother. The only way I'm going to survive this is if I figure out how to be close to her and be on her side. As a preteen, I finally figured out how to manage her. And the physical violence directed at me in the home drastically dropped once I figured this out. Are you ready for the weirdest part of this whole thing? At least to me, it's the weirdest part, and it's the part that took me the longest to be comfortable talking about. So I learned how to do nails. I eventually got my nail tech license, spa pedicures, and that whole thing. And then also during this time, she was going to school for massage therapy. I've always been very academic. Books were my escape through all of this. So I kind of studied alongside her when she was in massage school. And so I learned a lot. It lasted from when I was about 12 or 13 until I was about 18 and a half. Every single day, with a few exceptions of like if I had an after school event or if she had to work late, I would either give her a full spa pedicure or a minimum 1 hour massage. While in high school, while working, while maintaining straight A's, while in college, while again taking an ass load of courses in college and running the house. And that is how I managed to minimize the physical violence that was coming my way. Then it was mostly just mental and emotional. I do have some positive memories around her. I was having a hard time in high school and she made a scrapbook for me. She got like all of our friends and family to like write out what their favorite things were about me, what they admired about me, what they liked about me, and put them into like a little scrapbook and gave it to me. That got me through some really hard times. Looking back, I think that maybe she had some kindness to her motives and maybe she wanted to like show everyone what a great mom she was. But at the end of the day, some of those things that people said about me really encouraged me and got me through a lot of really hard things at her hands. But you know, that's beside the point. She loved the holidays. Usually the winter holidays were a fairly peaceful time. I still have a really positive association with those holidays. I think that at the end of the day, we were both robbed of what could have been a very fulfilling and beautiful relationship and childhood and motherhood experience because of broken systems and shitty choices. My parents' marriage started really disintegrating. It was pretty much over by the time I was in high school, but out of an abundance of compassion for her child, she made sure to wait until the day I graduated to notify my father that they were getting divorced. I knew that we were leaving for quite a while. There were so many nights that her and I just up and left the house and stayed with friends, stayed in the car, stayed at a hotel. We were in and out of that house so much during those last couple of years. And we had been secretly moving things out of the house for probably a month or two leading up to graduation. And so I knew they were getting divorced. I knew that her and I were going to leave together. And at this point, she had really done a really good job of constructing a narrative wherein I didn't have a good relationship with my father at this point in my life. Things were so rocky and unpredictable that I truly felt like I had to choose a parent. So I guess I'm on her side. We drove 6 hours north to Fairbanks, where I started my undergrad, and we lived together in an apartment that I paid for. I was going into healthcare. Looking back, I really think that I was her ticket out. She always hated Alaska, obviously wanted out of her marriage. I finished my super accelerated undergrad stuff. Then we moved to Texas together. I'm paying most of our way. She goes from job to job down here. She had a very hard time maintaining a job for longer than about a year. a lot of interpersonal conflict. And as I developed my independence as a person and met more people in the outside world and was like, huh, wait a second, maybe everything I know is a lie, I started to really start to stand up for myself a little bit more. And that was still met with physical violence. Finally, I just was like, I can't do this anymore. Our lease was up and she moved into a different apartment. I moved into my own apartment. I was still very emotionally enmeshed for quite a few years after that. But then when my brain decided that it was time to process the sexual abuse that had occurred, I started therapy. And as I was recovering from that, I started to really actually develop self-esteem for the first time in my life. Because the way that I was raised, everything good was from God and everything bad was because of me. In the process of realizing that I did not deserve what happened to me with the sexual abuse, I was like, whoa, maybe I didn't deserve some of this other stuff too. I did attempt to say, hey, can we talk about what happened and how it's not okay and how we can move forward and have a healthy relationship? I need to know that any animals or children that are in your care now or may ever be in your care in the future, because she was dating around at the time, are not going to be mistreated in the following ways. And I listed all of the ways. And I said, I need you to go to therapy, not just talk to your pastor. You can keep talking to your pastor, that's fine. But I need you to go to actual therapy because you deserve healing. And I deserve a parent who's going to be a healthy presence in my life. Predictably, that communication went extremely poorly. She just came back and minimized all of the things that I listed. Leaving was a very long process. Those first 6 months after going no contact officially damn near killed me. And I am not exaggerating when I say that. I was very lucky in finding some really wonderful mental health professionals. The first piece of advice that I would give is if you are still in contact with your perpetrator and you do decide to go no contact, please understand that it may be one of the hardest things you've ever done. And you might think, I've been through so much worse. It might be harder, especially depending on who the perpetrator was. For people who may find themselves in a situation where they have children and their abuser still has access to their children, if you aren't able to go no contact, figure out a way to make sure your kids aren't having the cycle repeated on them. I didn't have the understanding of it being torture, but I knew it was fucked up. A few years ago, when I was watching Criminal Minds, I actually had a flashback that led to me coming to understand my experiences as torture. One of the episodes, one of the agents gets abducted and tortured, and she's being blasted with water. I had this flashback to this pain all over my torso. Typically, when flashbacks are portrayed in the media, cut to like a grainy gray scene of a movie playing out in front of your eyes, but also it can show up as sensations in your body. I had to like pause the show and I recognized the flashback. I had been having it for a very long time. At that time, I couldn't stand to have cold water touch any part of my body. It causes physical pain. It feels like being hit with an electric shock. At that point, I had already gone no contact with her. I had already recognized that what I had been through wasn't okay. But I didn't realize that torture was something that could happen outside of war. I didn't realize it was something that could happen to kids in their own homes. I picked up my phone and I Googled, what's the difference between torture and abuse? And I found one article from 2014 that I cite all the time. And essentially, neglect, abuse, and torture all fall under the umbrella of child maltreatment. Neglect can be intentional, or in many cases in late stage capitalism, it is a result of a lack of resources. And I say that not to minimize the impact, but to frame the context. Because when we understand why and how things happen, we can understand why and how to prevent them. Child abuse was not even formally academically recognized until 1962. My grandma was 12. This was not that long ago. As society, we have an image in our mind of what an abused or neglected child looks like, but we don't have an image in our mind of what a tortured child looks like. there's a medical definition and then there's a working definition. The working definition that we use in the industry is when a perpetrator, usually a caregiver of some kind, establishes complete control over a victim's access to the basic necessities of life and then leverages that control in exchange for compliance, information, or some other desired behavioral outcome. The basic necessities of life are exactly what they sound like. If they don't want you to eat, you don't eat. If they want you to eat, you're going to eat. Forced consumption is a torture tactic. I went through it. A lot of people go through it. Solitary confinement, huge. All of the things that you would think of as a torture technique is what happens in people's homes, in intrafamilial childhood torture, and in institutional childhood torture. It happens in wilderness therapy. It happens in conversion therapy. It happens in all of these settings. The troubled teen industry is a huge perpetrator here in the US of domestic childhood torture. The medical definition is a longitudinal period of abuse characterized by at least two physical assaults and two or more forms of psychological maltreatment, such as terrorizing or isolating, resulting in prolonged suffering, permanent disfigurement or dysfunction, or death. The UN defines torture as any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or a confession, punishing him for an act he or a third person has committed or is suspected of having committed, or intimidating or coercing him or a third person, or for any reason based on discrimination of any kind, when such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official or other person acting in an official capacity. The reason why that definition is so important is because that is from the UN, and that sets the stage for international humanitarian law. That sets the stage for who qualifies for humanitarian aid. If you're a nonprofit that is seeking funding from the United Nations or a member state of the United Nations, and you're seeking funding to help torture survivors, the first thing they're going to ask is, how are you defining torture survivors? And it does bear mentioning that the fatality rate between the 2014 article and the 2024 article, which analyzed 63 victims of childhood torture and their outcomes, whether they lived or died, the fatality rate is 46%. If there was like a childhood cancer that had a 46% fatality rate, holy shit, can you imagine the number of 5Ks we'd be doing? So when I had that flashback watching Criminal Minds and I had that pain all over my body and I Googled the definition, that was the day I realized that what I had been through was torture. So 25 years later. In terms of the long-term effects of torture, a lot of that data comes from fully grown adults who are in the military who then undergo torture. But there's not a lot of research done, not a lot of understanding about what happens when you grow up in torture, when your mind and body develop on the scaffolding of being tortured by the very people charged with sustaining your life. That's a mindfuck. And so we don't know a lot in the literature about the long-term outcomes of that. But from my experience, one of the worst things was, and still is, nightmares. When I was really in the thick of mental health crisis from just all of this stuff coming to the surface, I would just wake up drenched in sweat, more exhausted than I was when I went to sleep the night before. It was just hell. There was no escape. It was flashbacks during the day, horrific nightmares at night. A couple months after this, we rescued this cat, and it was my first cat, and it was wonderful because I didn't have any horrible memories surrounding cats because we never had cats growing up. A few months after we got him, I noticed that I hadn't had a lot of nightmares. And then I realized one night, because I'm a very active nightmare haver, my cat, I don't know how, but he would hear when I was starting to have a nightmare, and he would get up on the bed and he would lick my face and very gently wake me up and soothe me back to sleep. over the course of time of him doing that, slowly those neural pathways started to heal. I started to have less nightmares in the first place because it like gave my brain a break from that vicious cycle. My sleep was actually restorative. Literally, I owe that cat my life. Music has been a really big part of my healing journey and also getting back in touch with my creative side. Creativity was very frowned on. Most things that I expressed passion about or interest in were sabotaged. So unpacking some of that and being able to lean into my self-expression, being able to lean into art. Art's kind of why the nonprofit that I run exists to this day. I'm really into making art with makeup, with cosmetics waste. That's what I do on my canvases. The first one was actually inspired by a quote that I learned about from watching Hannah Gadsby's stand-up Nanette, which I've watched like 3,000 times. And Hannah does a long bit in Nanette about art history. And Hannah talks about Picasso. One of his quotes, lesser known, is, "Each time I leave a woman, I should burn her. Destroy the woman, destroy the past she represents." Stated by a man who was having sexual relations with a 17-year-old while he was married and in his 40s, and is still to this day lifted up as a cultural icon. You better believe I had some feelings about that. So one night, I grabbed a canvas and some paint, Sharpie and a paint pen, and I wrote down that Picasso quote on the canvas. I was pissed. And I started like drawing lines from the junction points of the letters to like the edges of the canvas. I drew so many lines that you couldn't really read what it originally said. Watching these horrible words disappear like that was so therapeutic. And then I was like, so the shitty words, you can't see them anymore. They're still there. But then I started painting and I painted in all the gaps that were made by the lines, like a slightly different color in every gap. And then over the top, once it dried, I wrote a quote from Hannah's stand-up that says, "To be rendered powerless does not destroy your humanity. Your resilience is your humanity." And that night, that just scratched the right itch in my brain. And so I wrote that over that shitty quote and made a beautiful canvas. And I was like, wow, we can't change the context that we existed in, but we can control what we do with it. We can, against all fucking odds, create a better world. If you relate to the things that I have been through or similar, and you've been in therapy, you've been trying to heal, and it's not working, and you're feeling shame. For a lot of us, it started so early that this is pretty much what our worldview and our lives and our brains and our psyches and our bodies formed around. Of course, we have a hard time as adults. We have long-term health impacts, the injuries, the physical injuries, some of them never fully heal. The mental injuries, some of them never fully heal. But if we accept that, you know what? I went through something that a lot of people don't ever make it out of. I went through something that breaks grown-ass adults with training, and I'm still here, and I'm still in some capacity fighting for my life, then I think I can fucking live with this and figure out a way to be somewhat okay. And if we stop trying to live as if this never happened and instead accept it as part of our story and say, okay, this happened, what can I do to make living in my brain and living with these memories just a little bit easier every day? I think that is when we are able to really start to find some peace. Even every once in a while, some little glimmers of joy and happiness in life on this side of it. Doing this work and seeing the national and international conversation starting to shift and starting to recognize this issue and starting to make space for survivors to step into their power, that makes me really happy. And that's the thing about relational trauma. You can understand it academically, but the healing happens by experiencing relational safety. And it's a very long, very slow process. And it is something that I will be living with the rest of my life. But I am at a point now where I can and do live with it instead of it slowly killing me. This is a new field. We have to start somewhere in talking about it and in discussing the current statistics that we do have. They estimated that about 1 to 2% of cases related to child abuse met their medical definition of child torture. If we take that 2% estimation as a starting point and we extrapolate it by the number of children who are abused every year, and we know that that number is underreported, we're talking thousands of kids every year. That's not rare. It's happening. Someone in your neighborhood, someone in your apartment complex is probably being tortured right now. The statistics show us that 1% to 2%, but survivor testimony, anecdote, whatever you want to call it, shows that it's a lot higher than that. Just look at the number of people who go through the troubled teen industry every year. This is a religion problem. This is a legal problem. This is a gender problem. This is a power problem. It's all interconnected. So what restorative justice does is it says, how do we repair the community here? What needs to be done to repair this harm that was done? Nothing is going to change if culturally we don't acknowledge that these people are not separate from humanity. Also, that being said, there always have been people who will harm their fellow humans willingly and are not willing or able to stop themselves. As a society, we do need to do something to keep the community safe from these people. But I don't think that the answer is going to be in the form of stricter laws, because as we are seeing right now in the highest level of government, stricter laws do not matter. I would love to see prevention, but my lane is not prevention. My focus is on getting adult survivors connected with resources and establishing resources for adult survivors. That is where I do have an interest in policy, because we can try all day long to word the laws to make it more illegal for people to do these horrible things that are already technically illegal and horrible and nobody should be doing them. And then they're still going to get around the laws and probably walk free. What we can do is we can have some policymaking moments to say, hey, we need to include domestic childhood torture survivors in humanitarian aid frameworks that already exist for torture survivors. That is a policy that we can reasonably, feasibly expect to affect change. That's the direction I take my work. PrettyGraffiti.org, but pretty is spelled with an I. The link is all over the place on that website to register for aid. Right now, what we do have is we have a twice a month peer support group, and it started out as a support group for people with suicidal ideation who have survived torture, because the Venn diagram is pretty damn near a circle. And we have stayed true to those roots in that we're non-carceral, in that you are free to speak freely about those experiences and those thoughts, whether they are current, past, without fear of forced intervention. It's not clinician-led. It's not a substitute for healthcare. It's free to participate. All you need is internet connection. To be clear, we only work with people who are adult survivors. At this time, we are not equipped to help people who are not adults. If you're interested in donating, we would absolutely accept that. We are 501c3, nonprofit organization. So your donations would be tax deductible. We're currently running at a budget of like $1.73 per client or something. So we will not turn your money away. And then in terms of me and like my story as the founder and executive director, I'm all over TikTok and Instagram. Also, if you're a researcher or policymaker listening to this, please reach out to me on LinkedIn. That would be great. You can read my policy white paper that I just wrote. It's just Allie Davis. There's some weird underscores and stuff, but the easiest way is if you just search the hashtag childhood torture survivor, it'll pull up all of my platforms. My mission in life right now is, yes, I'm using my story, and it's personally healing to me to be able to speak out about these things after being in silence for so long, but it's bigger than that. To me, I don't want my legacy to just be, I went through this shitty thing and now here I am. I want my legacy to be like, I went through this shitty thing and I realized it represented this larger systemic issue, and now I'm busting my ass to try to make sure nobody ever has to die in silence again.
Thank you so much for your time, your energy, your advocacy, the change that you're making, the resources you're creating. You are a gift to the world, especially the survivor community.
Thank you so much for having me. It really means a lot.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I couldn't feel my legs. My arms went numb. I felt sick to my stomach. My brain couldn't keep up. They told me his real name, and armed with his real name, I could look at the very, very long history on the internet about the life and crimes that he had committed over the past 30 years. And it turns out that he is one of Australia's most prolific con men. And he had been arrested for swindling 15 Australian victims out of $7.6 million. And I was his last victim.
Thank you again to Mint Mobile for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget, if you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/WCN. That's mintmobile.com/WCN.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.